Good morning and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Things seem to be somewhat more orderly at the Kabul airport, but the big question that is looming is whether or not President Biden will extend the August 31st deadline. The Taliban is saying no, there's no extensions, there is a red line, but all indications suggest that the evacuation of Americans and our Afghan allies will not be completed by August 31st. So it is one of those big decisions that is hanging fire right now. And to talk about all of this, we are joined by Ambassador Eric Edelman, who is an American diplomat, served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, was the ambassador to a number of countries, including Turkey, expert on the Middle East. First of all, welcome back to the podcast, Ambassador.
Charlie, it's great to be with you. It's always great to be with you.
Well, this was a disaster foretold because you foretold it. So I guess I wanted to get your take on how did this happen. Earlier this month, you wrote a piece for the Bulwark talking about this as a predicting that the disaster is imminent to Afghanistan. The judgment the United States should draw down the troops was an arguable proposition when Biden made the call, and the people could disagree. What is inexcusable, you wrote, is the failure to foresee and plan for the downstream consequences. And you wrote that in early August. So I guess this is the question. You know, was this inevitable, and what really went wrong?
Well, you know, I've been concerned about this, Charlie, for a while. In addition to the Bulwark piece you mentioned, I wrote one with my former government colleague, Ambassador Bob Joseph, back a few days in the Bulwark, a few days after President Biden made the decision, saying that this, you know, could go very badly. And I repeated that in something I wrote in a dispatch in early May. And I did a conversation with our friend and colleague, Bill Kristol, in early July, worrying about the lack of urgency and apparent lack of planning. I think there's going to be a lot of efforts, I think, to go back and ascertain exactly what went wrong. I think the biggest thing that went wrong was that we pulled out all of our military support, including all the enablers that we have provided for the Afghan military, despite the fact that we basically trained the Afghan military to fight the way we do, which is to say, to fight with overwhelming information dominance, massive air power, contract logistics to keep aircraft, both rotary and fixed wing, in the air, and vehicles, you know, moving on the roads, and mission planning capabilities that are unique to the United States. And then we pulled that all out, and then we were surprised that they weren't able to fight. I mean, in some ways, this is a very sad replay of what we did with the Army of the Republic of Vietnam back in the 1960s and 70s. And I think that was the crucial thing that led to the rapid collapse.
So, you know, one of the arguments that we hear is that no pullout is going to be successful, that it was going to be messy whether it happened now or 6 months ago or 6 months from now or a year from now, that this was inevitable, that there was no way that we were going to disengage ourselves without something like this happening. So therefore, what you hear from the Biden folks is that some of this criticism is unfair because this was inevitable, this was baked in. I'm guessing you don't buy that.
Well, if it was inevitable and baked in, you would have thought that maybe they should prepare the American people for that, and maybe they should have moved with a little bit more alacrity to get both American citizens out and the people who helped us out. And obviously, they didn't do that because they didn't see this coming. So, I don't think this was inevitable. I think there were ways to get out that would have been different. I mean, of course, there have been a lot of comparisons to the evacuation of Saigon in the spring of 1975. But one of the things that's striking is that the U.S. had ended its combat role in Vietnam in 1973. So there were 2 years before the government fell, and there was much greater degree of preparation. So when Secretary Blinken says this is not Saigon, as he's repeated over and over again, he's right. In many ways, this is worse. And you look at the numbers of people who they got out in 1975 compared to what we're seeing now, it's, you know, just apples and oranges in terms of how much better prepared they were in 1975 than we are today.
I mean, obviously, Joe Biden inherited a situation from his predecessors. I mean, you have 20 years of presidents making decisions. So let's, can we just look back a little bit on what he was handed? I mean, Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo essentially surrendered to the Taliban, you know, forced the government to release 5,000 Taliban fighters, and set a deadline of May of this year. So, you know, where do we, you know, draw that the moment of maximum error, I guess, that would lead to this particular moment? Of course, the Biden White House is pointing back and saying, look, this was already done. This was already over. If we had wanted to stay in the country and keep the, you know, Bagram Air Base open, that we would have had to surge a large number of additional troops. We weren't willing to do that. So let's just talk about the Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump deal. Did that set the table for what we're seeing now?
Of course it did. And I think President Trump and Secretary Pompeo and my former colleague in government, Zal Kalwazad, will have a lot to answer for, you know, in the fullness of time. The agreement, not just the agreement, but the manner in which it was negotiated and reached, which was without the participation of the Afghan government, which was without a doubt a very flawed, you know, very flawed government in a variety of ways. But it was a government that had at least nominally had some assent of the Afghan people in repeated elections. There were a lot of problems with those elections, but, you know, nobody elected the Taliban. So, yes, I mean, they cut the ground out from under the government. They signed on to a deal that was supposed to be conditions based and then didn't insist that the Taliban meet the conditions. But where and it's fair, I think, for the Biden people to point all of that out. It's also the case, by the way, that President Trump, as you'll recall, as he was on his way out the door, was trying to accelerate the withdrawal, which would have been, I think, potentially even more catastrophic. But the Biden people had plenty of opportunity to, you know, go back and review the deal and walk away from it, given the fact that the Taliban were not abiding by it. Now, would that have perhaps required us to move some additional forces into the beyond the 3,500 we already had there? That's perhaps the case, but I don't think it would have required a massive combat presence. We haven't been really taking the lead in combat since 2014. And one of the, I think, errors going back to 2009 is we've had three consecutive presidents who never made the argument for why we needed to be there in the first place and didn't educate the American public. And there's a lot of, I think, amnesia, selective memory going on, and some young people who are too young to remember what it felt like on September 12, 2001, after we'd suffered the worst attack on the United States since Pearl Harbor. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around in the Bush 43 administration, which I served. We made mistakes as well. But that's different from the way this was carried out. That's a completely different question.
No, I mean, people you know, sometimes forget that this war was not that controversial compared to Iraq. They had bipartisan support. The Obama administration surged a large number of troops in, and this was you know, had broad support. And yet, as you point out, the American people and the political class just seem to have lost interest in it. We sort of became bored with the war. And nobody made the case. Nobody talked about it. So when Donald Trump ran for president saying, you know, we need to cut, we need to leave, it is not worth it, there was not that much resistance. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the reaction of the U.S. government as it was apparent that things were falling apart faster. And again, let's go back to your piece from August 4th, early, before the fall of Kabul. You said the reaction of the U.S. government and the Biden administration seems almost otherworldly. There did seem to be a disconnect as the Biden White House was watching this. A lot of their statements just didn't seem to be connecting with the reality on the ground. What did you mean when you said it was otherworldly?
Well, a lot of it was just hortatory injunctions for the, you know, Taliban to stop doing what they were doing, which was conquering the country, as if, you know, these exhortations, you know, on their own were going to have any impact. I mean, one of the things I said in the piece on August 4th was it wasn't too late to reinsert some U.S. forces to use air power to slow down the Taliban advance. They seemed to think that that the Taliban was not going to push all the way for a military victory, and there was just this huge disconnect, and that disconnect between what the administration is saying and what's going on the ground, you know, continues. It continues to this day. I've been involved in some efforts to try and help get some folks out from Afghanistan. And the descriptions that the Biden administration and the President of the United States himself have given the American people of what the situation is at Hamid Karzai International Airport are, you know, just not, you know, completely accurate. And you see that in the press accounts and the accounts in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, from reporters on the ground, as well as from, you know, outlets like CNN, where there was some very good reporting as well about the difficulties of getting people through. And I think the sad reality is, as you pointed out, we're bumping up against this August 31st deadline. My fear is we're going to leave an awful lot of people who helped us behind to be slaughtered by the Taliban.
So tell me a little bit, without giving away any secrets, what does it involve getting people out? Because we're getting these reports that, you know, how difficult it is to get to the airport, but there are other ways of getting out of the country. There have been reports of special operations to extract Americans from the city and get them to the airport. There are charter flights going out. We hear reports of a sort of a digital Dunkirk of other people who are arranging people to get out. Can you give me some sense of what it involves to get somebody out right now as we're speaking?
Well, they're just a variety of different people. And for every category of person, there are sort of different potential options. So in the first instance, they're American citizens, U.S. passport holders, or green card holders. They're in one category. Then there are the so-called SIVs. These are the special immigrant visa applicants, people who were interpreters or worked for the U.S. Embassy or for other U.S. government agencies. And then there are others who, you know, have a fear of a legitimate fear of persecution by the Taliban, who are so-called priority two, P2 candidates. But, you know, they're sort of very much at the, you know, back of the line, at least formally. And, you know, there are different lists. The State Department, Defense Department have different lists of people. I think a lot of the trouble people are having is, first of all, the physical crush of people at the gates of the HKIA, the airport, trying to get through physically is a problem. And then there's the question of having the right paperwork and then having that paperwork actually acknowledged by the people on the other side of the gate. You've got Taliban checkpoints to get through. You've seen all the reports, I'm sure, Charlie, of people being either turned away by the Taliban or beaten or whipped by the Taliban. So it's very perilous. There have been some periods of time over the last week or so since Kabul fell. I guess we're 9 days away from that now, of the embassy telling people don't come to the airport right now. The airport's been shut down for, you know, hours at a time with no flights leaving. And then there's the problem of what happens to these folks, you know, when they get out of Afghanistan. So the reports coming out of Doha, Al Udeid Airport, where a lot of folks have been evacuated to, is just heartrending to read. Axios has some reporting this morning about conditions, just humanitarian catastrophe with some 10,000 people, I think, there in an airport hangar that's not equipped or hasn't, at least to this point, been equipped to handle that kind of crowd of people.
So we're getting these reports of the daily negotiations and conversations between the Americans and the Taliban. I'm trying to imagine what those negotiations might be like. I'm sure you have, as a veteran ambassador, as a veteran diplomat, trying to imagine what those conversations were like. And we find out this morning that the CIA director had traveled to Afghanistan and apparently met with the Taliban. And I guess, give me your sense of how delicate this dance is, because so far no Americans have been killed. We clearly are relying, at least to some extent, on the restraint of the Taliban to keep this going. So just give me your thoughts about, at this point, relying upon and in some ways trusting that the Taliban will live up to some sort of an agreement to keep this process going for the next few days.
Well, it's a sad commentary on this entire matter that, you know, we now find ourselves as supplicants to the Taliban to allow this to go forward. I don't believe that the administration has used all of the leverage that it has in this situation. There are, you know, several things that we do have as leverage. I do think they're using the financial leverage, which right now is the most important. Let me just back up for one second, yeah, if I could, Charlie. I think, you know, the longer this went, the more our leverage would decline and the Taliban's would increase. That's, you know, that's a fact. Bill Burns, who they've sent, is former colleague of mine, a friend. He's extremely capable, very experienced, probably the most experienced person in the administration in dealing with this kind of circumstance or situation, although nobody really has a lot of experience in anything like this. But Bill is a good person to have there. There are some downsides, by the way, to having the CIA director taking on this kind of emissary role. But in this kind of extreme situation, I suspect there's not much alternative. So there is a certain amount of financial and diplomatic leverage. The administration has talked up the diplomatic leverage, although that, I think, is the weakest reed on which to rely. That's the supposition that the Taliban, this go-round, wants to not be a pariah state, wants international recognition, and therefore you can somehow leverage their desire for that into better behavior. You see some, you know, there's some, it's not completely delusional to think that. I mean, you do see evidence that the Taliban is trying to put a human face on its rule. But while I wouldn't say it's totally delusional, it's, as I said, the weakest reed on which, you know, on which to rely. The financial tool is significant, and they have frozen all the Taliban's assets, the U.S. government has. That are held in the U.S. in the Federal Reserve. That's important because it's the Afghan economy is in danger of just completely seizing up in the absence of access to dollars, and that's a pretty serious, you know, piece of leverage. But there's also military leverage if the United States were willing to use it, and I think the problem is that the president has completely undercut that. And the leverage there is this: the Taliban clearly want the United States to leave. I think the president's been very foolish to set these arbitrary deadlines that he has set, you know, September 11th, August 31st, et cetera. There'll be some very grim celebrations of September 11th in Kabul this year, I'm afraid. And it's going to certainly cast a pall over the commemoration of the date here in the United States. But the point is they want us out. And, you know, I think General McKenzie, the commander of CENTCOM, Bill Burns, Ambassador Ross Wilson, whom I also know well, he was my successor in Turkey, who is there on the ground, Admiral Vasily, former Navy SEAL, who is the commander on the ground. I think they could be telling the Taliban, look, you know, a week ago we had 600 people here, now we've got 7,000. If you, you know, cooperate with us, we will finish our work and we will be gone. Let us secure the routes and the roads and the entry points so that we can process people. You have said you want to declare an amnesty and you're not going to hold anything against anybody. Good. This is the time to prove it. You know, let let all these people who we want to get out, out. On the other hand, you know, if you obstruct us, you know, we could have another 7,000 people here easily. The Taliban do not want to fight us right now. They really don't. They know the formidable military capability we can bring to bear. But I'm afraid that, you know, the president's statements have sort of undercut the ability to make those kinds of threats. And of course, you shouldn't make those threats unless you're willing to follow through.
In the worst case scenario, and I'm guessing the fear in the White House is of a hostage situation, which we haven't seen so far, something like the Iran hostage situation, or really worst case scenario, if the Taliban starts shooting at the airplanes or trying to shoot them down. As you point out, that wouldn't be in their interest, but you can certainly imagine some sort of a retaliation if, in fact, the president says we're going to stay longer without a deal. Is that the kind of fear that they have, that right now everything's sort of in delicate balance and it may be messy, but it's happening? But if they push too far, so in some ways they're self-deterring themselves. They're not willing to flex those muscles at this point because they're afraid of how vulnerable they are to the Taliban or some of the offshoots of the Taliban. Not to mention the fact that it's not totally clear that the Taliban has control of all of its factions and fighters.
All of the above, Charlie. I mean, I think you're exactly right. I think that's they're very worried about that. They're worried about U.S. casualties first and foremost. I mean, it seems pretty clear that when the president gave his direction to the Pentagon back in April to organize the withdrawal, that he didn't want any casualties, when we withdrew. And it's one of the reasons why you keep hearing this mantra out of the Pentagon, which is speed is safety. They pulled everyone out very rapidly, well ahead of the deadline, and walked out of Bagram Air Force Base, essentially like thieves in the night, without even telling the local Afghan National Security Forces commander or having any kind of reasonable handoff. We're paying a price for that now. But I think there's enormous casualty sensitivity in the Pentagon and in the White House. I'm not suggesting we should be cavalier about the potential for casualties. It's very real here. Everything you outlined is a potential outcome. I think had they been tougher earlier with the Taliban, before the Taliban was able to completely flow into the city and establish itself, as I said, they would have had more leverage. With every passing day, as the Taliban's position becomes stronger, it becomes harder and harder to exercise any military leverage.
So, you know, the comeback that we're getting is, well, what was the alternative? You know, are you arguing for a forever war? Were we always going to stay there? Was there no exit? So what was the alternative? Staying there for another 20 years?
We still have forces in Germany. We still have forces in the Republic of Korea. 70 years after the Korean War broke out. I think we did not have to have a combat presence in Afghanistan, but I think we did have to have some kind of small train and equip presence that helped enable the Afghan military to hold its own in the hope that over time we could get a more capable Afghan government and be able to maintain a stalemate. A stalemate with the Taliban was actually to our advantage because it would prevent the country from becoming once again a potential base for jihadism. And one of the rationales that the administration has used for liquidating our presence there and getting out was that we need to repurpose all and reallocate all these assets towards the strategic competition mm-hmm. with China, which is the most important long-term strategic challenge to the United States. I agree with the latter statement that China represents the most strategic long-term challenge to the United States. But I think because of the way we've done this now, the result is going to be that we're going to have to devote more assets to combating terrorism than we had anticipated, because there's a very real chance that Al-Qaeda will be able to reestablish itself. We have also, I'm afraid, reduced our deterrent posture vis-a-vis China. You already see in Global Times, which is a English language PRC news outlet, editorial saying, oh, all you people in Hong Kong, you think the Americans are going to stick with you any more than they did with the Afghans? Or how about all you Taiwanese? You think the Americans are going to stick with you more? Now, these situations are very different. I'm not trying to compare them. I'm just saying there may be a sense in Beijing that the United States is in retreat and you know, might not be as willing to say defend Taiwan as you know we have appeared to be over the years.
Well, you made this point earlier this month in your Bulwark piece. You said, "What will the allies and partners we need to confront an aggressive China, India, Vietnam, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and others think when they see how the United States has treated Afghanistan, another neighbor of China's? The reputational damage," you wrote, "to the United States will be excruciating." And that's a very real price, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't think it's an accident, comrade, as I might have said in an earlier phase of my career, that the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, is in Southeast Asia right now trying to shore up our position there by asserting that the U.S. remains, you know, a global leader. Now, it's, of course, you know, she's going to be facing a lot of skeptical audiences, I think, because the narrative that is out there is that the U.S. is in retreat and is withdrawing from the world, and that the president's tone, particularly in his early remarks and interviews on this subject last week, I think had the flavor, as many commentators said, of America First light. Or as my colleague Elliot Cohn at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies said, the Trump administration with better manners.
So you had referred to this. This is one of the big tests, of course, is whether or not this will lead to a reconstitution of al-Qaeda. And, of course, the Biden administration is arguing that they'll maintain this counterterrorism overwatch from beyond Afghanistan's borders, that they'll be able to do it from, you know, someplace else. So give me your sense. I know you have been concerned about the terrorist future of Afghanistan. What is the danger that ISIS, that al-Qaeda, that other offshoots of these terrorist organizations will reconstitute and use Afghanistan as a base?
Well, there's a very real danger, and part of the problem is because we have lost any access to Afghanistan effectively, once we are out of Kabul, we will have much less ability to track that. That, you know, Bill Burns testified to that effect earlier this spring. He said it's just a fact that, you know, once we're out, we're going to lose, you know, eyes and ears on the ground, and we're going to have a much tougher time assessing this. Afghanistan Study Group, a bipartisan group chartered by Congress to review this, whose recommendations were completely ignored by the Biden administration, expressed concern that al-Qaeda could reconstitute itself, you know, 18 months to 2 years after U.S. withdrawal. Mm. Of course, they also, you know, believed or, you know, suggested that, you know, the government would last longer based on the same kinds of intelligence assessments that the administration has cited to say they thought they had more time. But now in the face of what's happened, we have to assume that it could happen more quickly, just as the collapse happened more quickly than a lot of people anticipated. It's a very complex picture with regard to terrorism. I don't want to suggest that it's simple. There are some reasons why some elements of the Taliban regime may not want to go back to having al-Qaeda as a sort of pilot fish in Afghanistan with bases and training camps, etc. But the Taliban and al-Qaeda are linked by, among other things, intermarriage. So it's going to be harder to sort of extirpate the al-Qaeda presence than people might think in the administration. It's also the case that the Taliban and ISIS are at loggerheads, which may be helpful here. One of the first things the Taliban did was pull an ISIS guy out of jail and summarily execute him when they took over in Afghanistan. So it's a complex picture, but it is very worrisome given what happened on 9/11. And we're kind of back where we were pre 9/11 in terms of our ability to understand what's going on the ground in Afghanistan, or we will be shortly. And we're not going to have access to a lot of the bases in Central Asia that we used initially in the Afghan operation and for some number of years in Uzbekistan and in Kyrgyzstan, because of the fact that the President Putin has enormous sway and influence there. He doesn't want us there. He's made that clear. He apparently told President Biden that at their summit. So we're going to be at some remove, and it's going to complicate everything in terms of terrorist overwatch, and it's going to be more costly as well.
Well, I want to talk about the implications of the flow of refugees, both in this country and in the region and in Europe. So let's talk about this right after this. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to The Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like The Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. We're back with Ambassador Eric Edelman. So let's talk about the refugee issue, because there's several different elements of this, and this is also very, very complex. One question, of course, is how many refugees will end up in the United States. There seems to be a huge bipartisan consensus that we ought to welcome the Afghan allies, the military translators who fought with our troops. I think it's something like 81% of Americans had no problem with that. But domestic politics being what they are, we're already seeing some folks on the right playing the refugee card, playing the card of how scary Afghans would be, and wanted to get you to respond to this. J.D. Vance, and I know we've mentioned him before, running for United States Senate in Ohio, has really been doubling and tripling down in saying that we shouldn't even be talking about refugees until all Americans are out. And then, in case there was any ambiguity about whether or not he was going to fearmonger on this issue, he went on Tucker Carlson's show last night. And this is what J.D. Vance said about Afghan refugees last night.
And just think about these ridiculous politicians. Unfortunately, too many Republicans who say things like, well, we want all of these Afghan refugees in our neighborhood. I mean, who really believes that? You cited the Pew Research poll. Another finding from that poll suggests that 40% of Afghan refugees, or excuse me, 40% of Afghans believe that suicide bombing is a reasonable way to solve a problem.
Great.
Who wants people like that in their community? Of course, 60% of Afghans don't believe that, but when you're not vetting people properly, you're going to get a lot of bad people in your communities. So let's just be honest about the fact that if we want to have a real country, we need to make sure that good people are coming into this country. There are ways to help the Afghans who really did help our military without sending tens of thousands of unvetted people into our country. And the fact that our politicians aren't honest about that trade-off suggests they're either hiding something or they're just stupid. Either way, it's not very good.
So, Ambassador, suicide bombers coming to a neighborhood near you.
Charlie, those sentiments are repulsive. And to use a phrase I used with regard to some senior officials in the Biden administration, who equated the government with the Taliban as, you know, just another party in a civil war, and why should Americans die for that? I described those sentiments as morally repugnant, and what you just heard, you know, falls into the same category. First of all, no one's bringing anybody in who's unvetted. All of these people have been enormously vetted. One of the reasons why the backlog of special immigrant visas is so long is because of the vetting process. One doesn't even, you know how to respond to something like that, because these are people who fought, bled, and died with us. And, you know, people like Adam Kinzinger and Congressman Jason Crow and others who've been in the fight and understand that have rightly been, critical of these kinds of comments.
No, and very eloquent about it. But this, the refugees are not just coming to this country, as you pointed out. We're, you know, early in the month, we were, you know, seeing, you know, Afghans trickling into Central Asia. And you pointed out, you know, the neighbors of Afghanistan, like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan are among the least free countries in the world. And it says something about the desperation of the Afghans that they would flee there. But you point out that if this trickle turns into a flood, as it did from Syria and Libya, it's going to be a challenge for the administration. We're already seeing the Turks pushing back very, very aggressively against Afghan refugees. And there is a potential, isn't there, that a massive flood of refugees might destabilize European politics and also neighboring Pakistan's politics?
I've been worried about this and raising this issue since the middle of April, when Ambassador Joseph and I had our piece in the Bulwark, where we raised precisely this problem with regard to Pakistan. People have forgotten, I believe, that before the civil war in Syria created the largest refugee population in the world of both external refugees and internally displaced people, the largest refugee population in the world was Afghans who had led the fighting first that attended the Soviet invasion and the long Soviet-Afghan war from 1979 to 1989, and then the rule of the Taliban. So there are already several million Afghans who remain in Pakistan, but I think you're likely to see, you know, more flowing, you know, into Pakistan, which has its own you know, violent Muslim extremist problem. There are Pakistani Taliban who are now pledging allegiance to the Afghan Taliban. I mean, one of the ironies here is that Pakistan and its integrated services intelligence, the famous ISI, who for years have played a double game with the United States, supporting elements of the Taliban while at the same time being allegedly a major non-NATO ally of the United States. You know, they may end up, you know, ruining what they have wrought. Mm-hmm. And there's major, I think, challenges. Pakistan is a perpetually fragile or failing state, but it also sits on top of a large growing nuclear arsenal. And the potential for those weapons to become available to extremists is not negligible, and it's something
terrifying.
It is terrifying, and it's something that I hope that the administration is taking very, very seriously, and planning for every contingency as best they can. Of course, that's not something they can or should talk about publicly, but it will also be harder. I think it's fair to observe it will be harder not having any U.S. forces next door in Afghanistan who might have responded in a pinch to to lock down loose nuclear weapons if they actually, you know, break free.
You mentioned in passing NATO, and it's worth reminding people that we were not alone in Afghanistan. That there are NATO allies who, based on the reports that I'm seeing, were caught very much flat-footed by the pace of the withdrawal and the collapse of Afghanistan. One of the big selling points of the Biden administration was that America is back, that we were going to repair our relationship with our NATO allies. And President Biden has said that he's not hearing anybody who's questioning America's leadership. That also doesn't seem to accord with other accounts. So give me your sense of how this affects our relationship with our NATO allies, who are also, and who still remain on the ground. I mean, the French and the Germans are still there. Others are still there. I think the British are still there as well, at least some of their troops. How has this affected our standing? How much damage has it done?
The damage is enormous. I think the fact that the president said what he said the other day was maybe one of the most troubling things I've heard him say, because it suggests he's not reading what is evident to anybody in the Financial Times, The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The New York Times are all reporting major concerns among allies about the United States. He was very slow, even after Kabul fell, to consult with our closest allies. It took several days before he spoke to Boris Johnson on the phone and Angela Merkel and then President Macron. So I'm very concerned about this. I think, you know, selling the proposition that America is back and that we are going to rely on diplomacy is going to be a very, very hard sell. I don't envy the task that Secretary Blinken has in front of him in trying to do that. Secretary Blinken had actually participated in a NATO meeting that morning virtually where many of these concerns were raised. So the president was either being disingenuous or he's really, really disconnected from, you know, from the realities on the ground. And there's been, you know, a fair amount of damage here to our standing in NATO. I would commend to everybody a speech by Tom Tugendhat, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the British House of Commons.
This is amazing.
Tom Tugendhat, and you know, there is no more pro-American politician in Britain than he. And yet his speech about what we did was absolutely searing, as was the, you know, statement issued by former Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Well, Tony Blair didn't mince any words. What was the language he used? He used some, what did he say, was imbecilic?
He said that the withdrawal was carried out in a way that, you know, essentially paid obeisance to what he called the imbecilic political slogan of ending forever wars.
Oh, my. Well,
totally.
The Pentagon is now saying that evacuation planes are taking off from Kabul every 45 minutes now. The White House is touting how many people were evacuated in the last 24 hours, which is all very positive. And it does seem that they are picking up the pace. Of course, we know what the numerator is. We don't know what the denominator is. In other words, right. You could say we've gotten 60,000 people out. Well, that's fine. But how many people, you know, what is the scope of the problem? Is 60,000 80% or is it 30% or is it 20%? And we don't have a good picture of that at the moment, do we?
Precisely. No. And that's one of the difficulties of parsing statements they've made. I mean, it's also not clear from the numbers they're given how many of these people are American citizens, how many are green card, how many fall into the various categories I mentioned earlier of folks who we have, you know, trying to get out. So it's obviously more is better, and being able to take off is good, but there's still a lot, you know, again, that hasn't been attended to. As I mentioned, it's also the question of what happens at the other end when these flights land.
Right.
Where are they going? What's happening to the people? How are they being processed? Is the International Red Cross been alerted? Are they there to receive these people? How, you know, it's there's still a very kind of haphazard, you know, quality to all this, which I think, belies all of the efforts to spin the PR of this into that, you know, they were prepared and they had done all the contingency planning that they needed to do. Clearly, they did not. And I do think that the, you know, U.S. military folks on the ground and the State Department folks on the ground are all doing their level best. You know, I am confident, you know, to get this right, but they're dealing with an intrinsically chaotic and unpredictable and very difficult situation.
Well, here are the numbers as of right now while you and I are speaking, because the Department of Defense just released its updated numbers. About 21,600 evacuated by the U.S. and coalition forces over the past 24 hours, 21,000, which was way above what they were saying they could do in 24 hours. Since August 14th, 58,700 evacuated. Since the end of July, 63, nearly 64,000 evacuated by the U.S. These are big numbers, indicating that it is a very, very impressive operation. We don't know, you know, how many people are going to be left behind. You know, on a more positive note, if in fact there is this massive Dunkirk-like operation, you know, might this take some of the edge off of the original debacle? Might we look back on this with a certain amount of, I don't know. I mean, pride seems way too strong a word, but is it possible that we could turn this around if we keep those numbers? I mean, 21,000 people every 24 hours would indicate that we are making a significant dent, or am I grasping for straws of optimism?
Well, I hope that's right. You know, I would hope that we're able to get everybody out and we look back and say, wow, you know, this was a Dunkirk moment. And we did everything we rescued. Everybody we possibly could, and you know, the very few people were, as a result, you know, lost their lives and as a result of this. But I think that's sort of what the administration is hoping for in the best possible case from their point of view. They keep pointing out that, you know, the American public supports their decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. But I do think it's very much a function of how you ask the question.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of poll data that shows that President Biden has taken a hit here. And I think in the end of the day, you know, a year from now in the 2022 and 3 years from now in the 24 election, you know, people may not hold it against President Biden if he decided to get out of Afghanistan. But the damage to the perception of the president's competence and the administration's competence, I think, will be indelible.
And credibility. And I think the most surprising thing was, at least his initial comments, for a president who's famous for his empathy, that he didn't seem that empathetic. So, I mean, there was you know, a competence gap, a moral gap, a credibility gap, and maybe an empathy gap. And, all of those, I think, are going to be, well, he's going to have to find a way to fix that. Ambassador, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it. Eric Edelman is counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Charlie. And I expect we're going to be talking about this again in the future, probably so.
I think that's certain. I think that's a date. Thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.